Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. This is going to be an empowering hour. The latest on health and healing, the newest study from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine on vegan diets. Also, I'm going to take your calls today on our voicemail line, and I don't know how many I can take, but I'll do as many as I can. And that voicemail line where you can call 24/7 and leave a question, try to make it as specific as possible. That number is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. Also, you can listen to this program anytime you want. It's on our archives. The archive number, call and you can download up to 5 hours of programming, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Today, if time permits, I'm going to share some thoughts from Adam Johnson at Truthdig about how biased the New York Times is when it comes to supporting coups in Latin America. Also from Chris Hedges' Truthdig, The World to Come. I also will go to part two of my study on vaccines, so I'll be sharing that. And mind you, you can download that study, all of its footnotes, and when I do an important investigative report, I do it so that a person could present it in a court of law and it would withstand critical expert cross-examination. That's the standard for everything, so you can rely upon it. Let's begin. The latest on a vegan diet. And by the way, there are now hundreds of studies from quality universities and medical schools showing that a vegan diet is the best diet for your gut hormones and satiety. And this was published in the journal Nutrients, and it finds that a vegan diet helps to promote the good, the beneficial, the healing gut hormones that are responsible for regulating your blood sugar and your weight and maintaining a, let's say, a normal appetite so you don't become ravenous. Researchers compared a vegan meal with a meal containing meat and cheese on hormone levels in a group of men and women, and also with type 2 diabetes, and then a group that were completely healthy. And the meals contained the same amount of calories and a ratio of macronutrients. So nutrient-wise, they were the same. Across all the groups, the vegan meal increased the beneficial gastrointestinal hormones compared to the meat eaters. And those hormones are involved in the regulation of your glucose, which means it's very important for pre-diabetics and diabetics to be on a plant-based diet. Also, it regulated better your insulin secretions. Again, insulin directly impacts your blood sugar. You don't want it spiking. You don't want it dropping. The body produces glucagon, a hormone that raises it when it's too low, and then insulin when it gets it to a level of higher, and you don't want a high insulin level. Also, what is called energy homeostasis, where you feel good, you have energy, you're not in the doldrums. Also, satiety and weight management. So, that's important. Here's what the MD, PhD, Director of Clinical Research at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine had to say. These beneficial gut hormones can help keep weight down, enhance insulin secretion, regulate blood sugar, and keep us feeling full longer. The fact that simple meal choices can increase the secretion of these healthy hormones has important implications for those with type 2 diabetes or weight problems, end quote. So once again, a plant-based diet wins on all levels. Healthier, a longer life, less chance of a heart attack and stroke and dying of all causes. So just, you know, keep that in mind. For those who think that drinking, well, it's not that bad. I mean, everyone drinks, right? Everyone, when I grew up, drank. All of our parents drank. not to get drunk, they just had to have that drink. Well, they paid a price. Everything that we were told about drinking was wrong. Because Rutgers University's latest study, published in Alcoholism Clinical and Experimental Research, shows that heavy drinking can trigger a long-lasting genetic change, resulting in an even greater craving for alcohol. Quote, "We found that people who drink heavily may be changing their DNA in a way that makes them crave alcohol even more." And this was the director of the endocrine program in the Department of Sciences, Animal Sciences, at Rutgers University. So, here's the question. How much, then, alcohol becomes too much? How about any alcohol? Yeah, you have to have the right idea at the right time. I had the right idea at the wrong time. I wrote a book on this, Alcohol and Nutrition. And it was okay in sales. It wasn't like one of the big best-selling books I'd done. And then from that, I wrote a series of articles. But it was at a time when people were socializing. The nightclub scene, the disco scene was in full swing, and so people would drink. Now, when my buddies and I and friends would go, we'd always have, what was it? It was Perrier. That was the only thing you could get, either a glass of water or Perrier. And so that's what we nursed throughout the evening. Everyone else would drink. Now, the fact that you do not get drunk doesn't mean that you're okay. With every single drink, you're killing over 5 million cells. Brain cells, kidney cells, liver cells, heart cells, yep, and also impacting your pancreas. And people then one day wake up and they've got problems. This is why. So one more reason why we shouldn't drink at all. Now, another study is about maternal vitamin C treatment can cut baby's risk of heart disease. This is very important. This is from Cambridge University. And this is about maternal treatment with vitamin C, which, well, we all know is very important. And it can help cut down the complications of pregnancy and protect the baby from developing hypertension and heart disease in adulthood. So when we talk about epigenetics, meaning what we do today can impact another whole generation in the future. So we have to have a healthier protocols for women who are pregnant. I'll be writing a long article. I'll probably publish it in the Townsend Letter for doctors. And I will then distribute it to everyone on the internet who wants to know what a pregnant woman should do. What foods, what juices, what nutrients to protect herself and the developing fetus. So we need to get more nutrients like vitamin C. Why? It's simple. Vitamin C is one of the best single nutrients to protect you from cardiovascular disease, including high blood pressure, which is part of cardiovascular disease, and stiff blood vessels, and chronic hypoxia. Hypoxia, H-Y-P-O-X-I-A, hypoxia means lower than normal oxygen levels, and that would be in the developing baby within the womb, and it's one of the most common outcomes of complicated pregnancies in humans. And it occurs as a result of problems with the placenta, and that can occur in preeclampsia and gestational diabetes or maternal smoking. So a lot of people don't think that there's a problem with what they're doing, and there is. So I want you to be able to understand we can do a lot to help the baby develop and have less problems future in life. Hysterectomy triggers bad effects on brain function, according to this new research from Arizona State University. So according to estimates, a third of all women receive a hysterectomy, which is the surgical removal of the uterus, by the time they're 60. Amazingly, researchers estimate that as many as 20% of these surgeries aren't even medically necessary. That's why I'd like for anyone who is in other or conditions that you would require. But get into the hands of a holistic-minded OGBYN person before you decide what to do. Let's just put aside for a moment how disturbing it is that so many doctors are willing to put patients under the knife when it's not warranted. Instead, let's consider some startling new research out of Arizona State University. About 600,000 hysterectomies performed every year in the United States. And one of the things we're noticing, it has a high prevalence of memory loss. So that's what we should be considering. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Epidemiology. Also, ginger powder, we know it's good for upset stomach. We know it's good for nausea. Why do you think in hospitals for decades they gave ginger ale? Now, that's a poor substitute. It does have some ginger in it, but not a lot. But if you had ginger fresh and you made a ginger tea out of it, that would be good. Or you could take a ginger capsule. But ginger powder is clinically effective to treat common migraines. This is from Zanjan University Medical Science in Iran. So despite the medical field's progress in the management and treatment of migraine, the chronic neurologic disorder remains a difficult condition to effectively and completely alleviate. I'm suggesting cannabis oil is one really good way of treating migraines, along with seizures and autism and other conditions. But now they're looking at this. Not an over-counter product, no adverse side effects, no dependencies, just an herbal remedy for chronic conditions like migraine. It is one of the most powerful medicinal herbs, and ginger is recognized for its wide-ranging therapeutic properties, with applications spanning from motion sickness to vertigo to vomiting to flatulence to pain. And it also helps reduce high blood sugar. It normalizes blood pressure. It improves your lipid profile. So just add this to it. And this was published in Phytotherapy Research. And also, there is a condition. It's not that common, but it's still a serious condition. It is a condition that it's a APS, antiphospholipid syndrome. And it's acquired autoimmune disorder, and it manifests clinically as recurrent venous and arterial thrombosis that can lead to heart attacks and stroke and pulmonary embolism and or miscarriages, and it can kill you. And also is responsible for fetal death. And they've just come up with some new research in Spain that ubiquinol, U-B-I-Q-U-I-N-O-L, ubiquinol, or also known as vitamin B12, has been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease by inhibiting the LDL oxidation and decreasing the production of this pro-inflammatory cytokine and blood viscosity. So, good news for that condition that really had no beneficial effects under other therapies. And also, from the University of California at San Diego and Columbia University, a new study published in cannabis and cannabinoid research that cannabis as an adjunctive second-line therapy to treat chronic peripheral neuropathy can be effective at reducing pain and is cost-effective. And finally, from the University of Reading, which is in the United Kingdom, wild blueberry supplementation improves cognitive performance of children. Studies looking at the effects of nutrition on brain development have typically focused on the benefits of multivitamin supplements for cognitive performance in children. But a growing body of research now shows that flavonoids, flavo, F-L-A-V-A-N-O-I-D-S, flavonoids, that's a family of phytonutrients found in fruits and vegetables, also play a role in supporting cognitive function in animals and humans. Now, you've heard me mention many times berries. In particular, they demonstrate an ability to mitigate the neuron stress and enhance pathways associated with brain signaling. And previous studies have shown that supplementation with blueberry anthocyanins can improve visuospatial memory and enhance performance on executive function tasks. Grapes are good. They're rich in anthocyanins. Blueberries are good, right at the top of the list. So some things can help us. Again, all these are important. One last thing from Harvard School of Public Health. higher dietary fiber intake in young women can reduce your risk of breast cancer. That's important. This was published in the journal Pediatrics. So good quality plant-based fibers, I'm suggesting 40 to 50 grams a day, can help prevent breast cancer. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back in to your calls.
This is Bob in Brooklyn. I feel it would be useful to have an examination of the base of the Trump voters, the white, uneducated white working class. In Brooklyn here, I'm involved with the local Democratic Party. I belong to a Democratic club. I do a lot of campaign volunteering. And my area are mostly Trump supporters, uneducated white working class. And talking to them, they put aside their own best interests, Medicaid, Medicare, health care. These people belong to labor unions very often. Very often they're government workers. They put all of it aside because they're preoccupied with race. They're obsessed with it. They love Trump because of his immigration policies. These people absolutely have a pathological hatred for non-white people. They have a pathological hatred for Muslims. And that's their only concern, and they're absolutely obsessed with race, and they are hopeless. Ralph Nader thinks you can have a left-right coalition of working-class people. He's mistaken. And, well, that's, I would like to, I think we need to examine the inveterate racist Trump supporters. Bye.
Wow. How do I begin? First of all, your statement itself is extremely biased. I won't say you're a racist, but when you denigrate 62 million people for how they voted, and by relegating all of them to being uneducated white racist, that is lacking merit, reason, and understanding. As you've heard if you've listened to this program, I supported Jill Stein, before that Rocky Anderson, before that Ralph Nader. I'm unapologetic in supporting progressive causes. I did not support Hillary Clinton because I made it very clear that I had studied her background far more than any of the journalists that were there to, as supplicants, to praise her and to look at nothing that she had done wrong. Trump's a different character. He is completely unconventional. Therefore, we could expect the base of his support to be unconventional also. Thus, no one kind of Trump supporter. Now, most surveys and research shows that Trump supporters are pretty much the traditional Republican rank and file voters. But then that is to assume that the rank and file Republicans are the same as rank and file conservatives. And that's not true. There's a great divide between the two. And most surveys and research show that Trump supporters, at least 80% of the voters in 2016 also voted for Mitt Romney earlier. They are tax cut advocates, evangelicals, conservative Catholics, gun rights supporters, business types favoring deregulation. So these are all different groups. Now, if you own a small business and you're not getting any help from anyone, and your landlord has got you by the throat, and this is something that's a reality, because the landlords control in New York State and New Jersey and Connecticut, the surrounding tri-state area, they control everything. For example, if you're a small business person in New York State, you pay the landlord's property taxes. And that's ridiculous. You shouldn't have to do that, but you do. And hundreds of thousands of businesses closed because of it. So if there is an effort and in this case, my brother Stephen has led for 40 years the effort to protect the interest of small businesses, the small bodegas, the small little mom-and-pop stores, that are the small Chinese restaurants, any kind of small business, of which there are hundreds of thousands representing millions of employees. They have not had any power whatsoever. So if they were so frustrated by the promises made by others in local government, state government, or federal government, then you might get a backlash vote. That does not mean they have researched Donald Trump or understood him. These are not racist. These are not uneducated people. These are some of the hardest working, decent people you could imagine. These are people who have many good values. But you're categorizing all of them. You've just condemned almost one-fifth of the entire American population. Think about what you've just said. Also, the median annual income of Trump supporters is $72,000. That's not poor, quote, poor white trash you're talking about. And then are you going to make the same claim about people who are poor, that someone's poor, they're trash, that they're racist? Please use some reasoning before you make such blatant broad-swipe condemnation. You sound more like one of the people on the adverse committee of BAI making a harassing statement than something that is measured and thoughtful. Anyone who's paranoid and fearful and hateful about the myths of liberal, meaning the socialist, the atheist, the communist, voted for Trump because they've been lied to and they had been disappointed for so long. Do you want me to go down some of the reasons? Well, how about this? How about Citizens United that allowed, and that was under Democrats, allowed the massive billionaire money to pour into elections so they could select the people when they wanted, then pay to get them elected? That's not fair representation. Think about all the wars around the world that they sold us and lied to. How many of those people, Republican and Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, that supported the war, how many have been held accountable? How many were told you can't run for office, any office, because you use your position of power and your position of access to the media to convince us that we were at a direct and existential threat if we didn't go in there and take out Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or Assad in Libya? All lies, not accidental lies, not unintentional, actual lies. Does it mean then that the people who voted for Clinton are highly educated, completely humanitarian, and ethical? Just the opposite, based upon the records of the, I'm talking about the politicians. But I wouldn't blame everyone who voted for someone like Obama, because we want to have faith. We want to believe in someone. We want to believe their messages, especially if they're charming and they seem sincere. But then we don't look at the details. We don't look at the fine print of what they've done when they spied on us. How about the prison industrial complex? How about asset forfeiture? Billions of dollars stolen from people? That was under Obama. How about the National Defense Authorization Act? That was under Obama. Are you going to then suggest that everyone who allows tyranny, fascism, totalitarianism, betrayal of all of our treaties, creating the genocide in Libya by selling arms to Saudi Arabia? What about the degradation of our environment? Obama supported the Keystone Pipeline, as did Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton had 46 emails that showed that she had her State Department pressure every major country to take GMOs. Obama passed the DARC Act. There are hundreds of things they did wrong once in power that show that they betrayed their base. But the base feels, what can I do? The Cato Institute analysis, which is a libertarian think tank, five main groups. Now, imagine this. You've got your staunch conservatives, about 31%, and these are moral conservatives, and these are nationalists, nativists, and they have specific views on America's identity. And they're older men and women, and they're well-educated, and most likely are gun owners. Are you going to say then anyone who owns a gun is somehow genetically defective, that they're so insecure that they're so paranoid, they're so engaged in conspiracy theories, that they shouldn't have the gun? Are you going to take that clear back to all the founding fathers that had guns, all the other people, including people of all backgrounds and all respects, that believe that we should have the right to bear arms? Now, what kind of arms is a separate story, but once you start opening the door and say, anyone who owns guns, clearly, then it's a big mistake. And that's what happens if you oppose taxes, if you want the government better regulated. Now, there's a lot of this stuff. Free markets. I'm opposed to free markets. I'm opposed to neoliberal policies. I'm opposed to globalization because of what is given away to the people who are making the money and what is taken from the people who are exploited for that, including natural resources. But a lot of people voted because they were so disappointed. I'm out around the country. I'm filming all the time. I speak with people. You would like to believe that only a small group in New York, in Washington, and Los Angeles have their finger on the heartbeat of America. They're wrong. People are outraged by identity politics, outraged by these divisive tactics of separating people. And so think again and ask yourself, what did the Democrats do over 30 years of failing to honor their pledges for the environment, to de-ghettoize America, to provide proper support for public education, to have free college education, at least public college, not private, and universal health care? And they abandoned every single one of those. They compromised. Well, who did they compromise with? They compromised to the corporatist. So when you talk about Republicans are this and Democrats are that, they're both corporatist. They're both neoliberal. They're both substantially of the mindset that who pays the most money gets their attention and loyalty. And keep in mind that there are a lot of Democrats, progressives, and Republicans who are anti-elites, mostly progressive Democrats. And the only main difference for why they would vote for Trump is stands on immigration and the Muslim travel ban. Economically, progressive, like preservationists, and they believe that the economy is rigged. They are right. So look at each part of what a person believes in and ask yourself, who are these people? Look at the disengaged, the people who don't vote or don't trust either party or don't belong to either party. And you're dealing with 104 plus million Americans, all of whom belonged to some party earlier in their life. Why did they stop? There's a lot of psychological issues as well. And you have to take all this into account. Then you can better understand what a diversity of people thought when they stopped voting for the Democrats or Clinton. And would you have been all right voting for Clinton? Because the assumption is, and it's just an assumption, that if we shouldn't vote for, if we voted for Trump, we were voting against our own interest and we should have voted for Hillary Clinton. There would be no expose of the current coup that's occurring at the Justice Department, CIA, the National Security Agency. We would not know how deep the deep state is. We would already probably be at war with Iran, and we would have had massive privatization and exploitation. That's what came under the Clintons and Obama. So neither party is acceptable to many of us. We want to see new parties. We want to see open forums. We want to see the Green Party, the People's Party, the Justice Party. We want to see the Conservationist Party. We want to see people who are more populist and care about each other and nature, human rights, here and around the world. Right now, we don't have that. Right now, what do you have? You have a group of people who have all been compromised. Let me just think of who would be one of the most compromised. Kamala Harris would be one. And what do you know about her? Have you done your homework? She's charismatic. She's popular. She right now would probably be going up against Bernie Sanders. So she's trying to reform her image into being part Obama in her charm and part Bernie Sanders in her populist socialist politics. Right, that's an interesting political alchemy to pull together. She might be able to do it. In which case, that's as far as anyone's going to criticize her. But if you look at her record, you would think, whoa, do I want another Hillary Clinton just by a different name in office? As Attorney General of California, she was not progressive on any issue. There's an interesting article, a Jacobin article, about her calling her two-faced. Each of her progressive achievements are matched by a conservative, regressive one. She has been a champion of the old, tried, tough-on-crime rhetoric, and that was started by Hillary and Hillary Clinton. For a long time, she was urged to move forward with criminal justice reforms, but she said no. She opposed them or ignored them, and that angered human rights activists. She failed and or ignored to uphold wrongful convictions that were based upon police misconduct, including tampering with evidence and false testimony. I'll give you an example. In one case, a police lab technician had 600 cases filed against her, and she fought against prosecution. Fortunately, she lost. All those people were wrongly convicted. 600 of them by one lab technician. And yet she protected that lab technician. Other cases where she refused to side with wrongful convictions. Many cases where she upheld harsh sentencing, get this, even after evidence proved the person innocent. Daniel Larson, 28 years to life for concealed weapon, it was a knife, although a trial lawyer was found utterly incompetent, didn't invite a single witness, and yet there were over a dozen witnesses, including I believe he was a chief of police of another city, and he was there. They were all witnesses and said another person had a knife and threw it under a car. This man had no knife. He was later, he filed repeatedly, and he had no money. He was given this long sentence by her, and he was then found by the Innocence Project to be innocent. And she didn't want to let him out of prison. In fact, she didn't let him out of prison for another 2 to 3 years till the court forced her. And because she said that he did not file his petitions in a timely manner. Now, wrap your mind around this. This is the woman who might be president. Yes, you've spent, I don't know the exact number of years, but I think it's around 16 years in prison for a crime you did not commit. You're an innocent human being, but because you didn't have a procedural filing in time, you should stay there for the rest of your life. Wow. That should tell you everything you need to know to disqualify a person, but it won't. It won't. Nothing I'm telling you will disqualify her. John Baca, a murder conviction after judges found prosecutor gave false evidence. Kevin Cooper, a death row inmate. Harris opposed his request for DNA testing to be proven innocent. I read that in the New York Times. So here's a man on death row who proves by DNA he's innocent, but she didn't want to give him the DNA test. George Cage, with no criminal record, was charged many years later with sexual abuse of a stepdaughter. Gage was convicted, although prosecutor withheld evidence, including medical reports showing that the stepdaughter had a long history of being untruthful with law enforcement. Her own mom called her a pathological liar. But Harris defended the conviction all the way up to the U.S. Appeals Ninth Circuit Court, where it was overturned. But that man would have stayed, George Cage would have stayed in prison for the rest of his life based upon false testimony, and she should have known that. And yet also a huge supporter of punishing familial DNA testing and collecting anyone, mining anyone, whether you're charged or not. And by the way, this is banned in Canada, but some states, I think it's only Maryland, D.C. also outlawed. So if the police come and want your DNA, she wants the DNA in a police file. Why should you have your DNA forcibly taken? They can strap you in a chair and take your DNA. She supports that. She's a strong proponent of civil asset forfeiture. In fact, she personally sponsored a bill to allow prosecutors to seize assets before any charges were even filed. She opposed an earlier bill to reform asset forfeiture. The bill passed, but then later Harris helped law enforcement groups to scuttle it. She, what else? Let me just think. She refused to reduce sentences, including drug possession, for minor low-level felonies. And that's two-thirds of all Americans oppose mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. And she strengthened the private and industrial prison complex, big supporter of private prisons. She's been overly supportive and trusting of law enforcement. And she opposed the bill requiring, requiring her own office to investigate shootings involving officers. And her previous position on law enforcement had been frequently criticized by the ACLU. And she also has a, if you think because you're African American or person of color that you're going to get any kind of understanding, forget about it. There's a whole lot to read on that. And also, she appealed against a federal judge ruling that the death penalty was unconstitutional. She's a very pro-death person. And she opposed marijuana reform for recreational use and to reversing it when it showed to be popular. So these are some of the things, just some of the things that you don't know. Oh, by the way, her own office, when it was suggested that they start letting prisoners for nonviolent crimes out, she said no. Why? Because we need them for fighting fires at $1 a day. Mm-hmm. Well, that shows me a whole lot. So, sir, you should think before you try to destroy the image of 62 million Americans. Are there racists? Are there bigots? You bet. Do some of them surround Trump? Always got a hardcore base. But you didn't parse your thoughts. You made it all-inclusive. That is troubling to me. We'll take another call.
Hi, Gary. First of all, thank you so much for all your great information. You have definitely helped me a lot, and I'm sure thousands of other people. My question is about a couple of therapies that I've never heard you discuss. The first one is ozone therapy. I've had this recommended to me by a naturopathic doctor as a way to reduce my BPH. And she is suggesting it could actually shrink the prostate and help with the trips to the bathroom at night. So just curious your opinion, because when I discussed this with my traditional doctor.
Okay. I am not aware. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just I'm not aware of any research showing that ozone will shrink an enlarged prostate. I've written a very important scientific article on ozone, and it's on our website. It was published in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. I did a very important documentary. I reviewed over 5,000 scientific studies on ozone and what it will do and what it won't do. It's primarily good for viruses and bacteria and done properly. So you have to get the person who's not going to exploit you, because it's very inexpensive, so it shouldn't be charging. What I believe a doctor should charge no more than, you know, $50 treatment. And also you should be tested before you get it, and you should be tested at the end of 4 weeks to see if your viral loads or bacterial are reducing. If not, some doctors just keep you on the protocol because it's making the money, and that I'm opposed to. But there is benefit to it, okay? But I'm not aware of any benefit for that. We'll squeeze one more quick call in. Do we have one more?
Yeah.
Yes, no?
Hi, I'm calling to leave a message for the Gary Null Show. Hi, Gary. Love your show. I've been a listener for nearly 25 years, and my question has to do with mixing oils such as black seed oil and coconut oil along with apple cider vinegar in smoothies. In my smoothies, I usually start with a base of homemade almond milk made from organic almonds, and then I add a banana plus a couple of other fruits or veggies plus some ice. Then I like to add black seed oil and coconut oil, along with apple cider vinegar, since I've heard so many good things about them, mostly on your show. Is there any danger that comes from mixing these oils together or from mixing them with apple cider vinegar? Again, the oils being black seed oil and coconut oil. Thanks very much for your answer, and keep up the good work, please. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No, there's no problem at all. The only question is, if you're able to tolerate black cumin seed oil, some people have to really dilute it, and therefore I suggest a banana in a shake. Protein shake is the best way. Some of us can just take it. I just take it, drink it down. And I'm sure others can too, but for the vast majority of people, I would suggest in a shake. And all the combinations you just mentioned, almond milk, that's all fine. There's no counterindications that I know of for that. Okay? Back in a moment with part two of our in-depth investigative report on vaccines. And this is a continuation of a study on the subject, very important subject, autism and vaccines and other neurological impairments due to the vaccines. I gave you part one. You can download it in our archives. And the full article is there for you to download, read, and share. There is a Dr. Lucija Tomovic, along with a professor, Christopher Shaw, and they've studied not just mercury, but they've studied aluminum in vaccines. And why am I saying that? Because once mercury, or the important vaccines, all had mercury at one time, then there was shown to be an association of toxicity, because all the journals on science involving toxicity show that mercury is a neurotoxin. There is no safe amount of mercury, none. So then they started to wean out the mercury in vaccines, and then the results did not show a reduction in autism. So they see, see, it wasn't the mercury after all. They're wrong. Because they also didn't look at all the other combined ingredients, including the adjuvants. An adjuvant is put into a vaccine in order to overstimulate the vaccine's effect in the body. So here we have scientists who then began to study aluminum in vaccines extensively. In a 2011 study published in the Journal of Inorganic Biochemistry, their team found a significant correlation between exposure to aluminum in vaccines and the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder. Applying a statistical measure used to assess the causation inherent in a correlation, they were able to confirm, quote, the correlation between aluminum in vaccines and autism spectrum disorder may be causal, end quote. In a comprehensive overview of the literature on aluminum adjuvants, the two professors bring together studies confirming that molecules are not only neurotoxic, meaning the brain, but also endocrine disruptors, genotoxins, immunotoxins, and pro-inflammatories. They also interfere with glucose metabolism, membrane receptor signaling, mitochondrial functioning, and adenosine triphosphate, or ATP energy transfer, among other homeostatic functions. And while aluminum's environmental ubiquity is a source of harm on its own, the body is able to excrete much of what it consumes through food and drink. When injected, however, the human brain doesn't stand a chance. Dozens of studies in the peer-reviewed literature have confirmed that aluminum adjuvant particles can cross the blood-brain barrier, triggering a devastating inflammatory response in brain tissue. During infancy and childhood, the blood-brain barrier is at its most permeable, rendering the administration of adjuvant containing vaccines especially destructive. There was a Professor Vargas and Associates published a paper on the link between what are called microglial activation and autism, and that was in 2004, demonstrating that autistic patients suffered from lifelong low levels of immunoexcitation of the brain. In the study, it's been replicated many times. That's another association. A 2017 study by Dr. Crepeau and others required a wholesale reevaluation of everything we know about aluminum adjuvants. The researchers found counterintuitively that it was actually the smallest dose of the adjuvant, which is aluminum, that produced the worst neurologic toxic effects. And higher doses were seen to trigger the formation of protective granulomas. That's a function of the body's natural immune defenses against hostile foreign intruders. But in small doses, the aluminum nanoparticles were taken right up by monocytes, these are your white blood cells, as part of the immune response to the vaccine. So riding those cells all the way to the brain, the lowest dose subjects were those who displayed marked neurobehavioral deterioration. So let us just repeat this so it's understandable. The smaller the dose of aluminum, the greater the negative impact because the nanoparticles get through the brain-blood barrier easier. No studies were ever conducted to evaluate the safety of aluminum adjuvants before drug makers decided to use them in vaccines. None. Indeed, the FDA ceiling on how much aluminum a vaccine can contain is based upon the substance's efficacy in enhancing the vaccine's antigenicity, not how it is tolerated by the body. What an oversight. This is just inexcusable bad science. In public health science, it gets an F. The mechanisms by which aluminum acts as an immune adjuvant is well known in the scientific literature. Even though the CDC limits aluminum in some feeding solutions for safety reasons, with a vaccine schedule that only expands, never contracts, always more, never less, children today are injected with many times the aluminum load of children 30 years ago, and the weight of the evidence that this substance is toxic cannot be ignored. A study published in 2018 points to fluoride as another possible trigger for the immunoexcitotoxicity that has been indisputably linked to autism. A group of scientists, headed by a Dr. Strucknecka, discovered that the synergistic effects of aluminum and fluoride exposure resulted in a far worse inflammation in neural tissue than aluminum or fluoride alone. Hence, you've got negative synergistic effects. Worse, the combination of the two neurotoxins has a marked effect on cell signaling and nervous system function and neurodevelopment when present in lower concentrations than either substance alone. And because the U.S. is one of the dwindling number of countries that persist in adding the industrial byproduct fluoride to its drinking water, despite the overwhelming burden of scientific proof of its negative health benefits, they don't exist. Most children exposed to excessive aluminum through their vaccination schedules are also consuming excessive fluoride, doubly dangerous in conjunction with the biopersistent adjuvant. Now, the CDC knows aluminum adjuvants are as toxic and damaging as thimerosal, mercury, and has exploited this knowledge in the studies it has conducted to, quote, prove vaccines have no connection to autism. The agency's scientists administered a placebo to the control group, and guess what? It still contains the deadly adjuvant, ensuring that they will be poisoned and thus they'll show no noticeable difference in autism rates. Your placebo should be completely inert. Well, if you're using a placebo that has aluminum in it, then it's not inert. This is the CDC. How can they possibly get away with this without the rest of the scientific community and the editors-in-chief of all the major scientific magazines challenging them on this? This is a legitimate challenge. At this point, with so many papers in the peer-reviewed literature proving the neurotoxicity of aluminum adjuvants. Such a so-called mistake in research methodology can only be a deliberate attempt to obfuscate the reality. To administer an inner placebo would be to open up the trial to the possibility of meaningful results, a mistake they vowed never to make again after Simpson would. The indictment of aluminum adjuvants should have been complete with a 2015 study published in the Journal of Neuroimmunology. The study compared three groups, one receiving a tuberculosis vaccine that contained no aluminum adjuvant, one receiving aluminum-containing hepatitis B vaccine typically given to babies on their first day outside of the womb, and one control group. The hepatitis B group manifested heightened levels of IL-6, interleukin-6, the cytokine marker for autism, and impeded synaptic plasticity in the hippocampus, a brain area particularly sensitive to the effects of neuroinflammation. The tuberculosis group showed no levels of IL-6 increase and no increase in synaptic plasticity. The study seems to confirm that it is not the vaccine as such that has caused such a devastating increase in neurodevelopmental disorders, but medical authorities refused to address the presence of neurotoxic adjuvant in one of their most lucrative products. Japan discontinued the MMR vaccine in 1993, 4 years after imposing it on its citizens on a mandatory basis. The rate of adverse events, including meningitis, limb loss, and death, was 2,000 times higher than expected, and the shot was pulled after doctors confirmed it had entered at least one child's nervous system and probably at least three. Japan not only coincidentally has one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world. Meanwhile, the United States, and specifically California, now has mandated child vaccinations, and several other states have proposed similar compulsory vaccination laws, while their constituents are bombarded with news stories playing up every measles case as the new bubonic plague. The Idaho Department of Health and Public Information Officer expressed his regret that his state was unlikely to pass such a measure, complaining to Reuters that in Idaho, quote, there's a pretty strong culture of individual rights. I want to share more, but we're running out of time. I will do part three tomorrow. Also, for our sister stations who are not able to listen, the members not able to listen because possibly they don't have internet access, last night's program on the truth about our position in Venezuela with Greg Pallas, two dynamic speakers who had fact after fact for 55 minutes. I'm going to play that on our sister stations such as BAI in New York, because a lot of people say, I didn't have a chance to hear it or I couldn't hear it, so you'll hear it tomorrow. For the others, I'll do part three tomorrow on this topic. And one final thought. Yesterday, when someone asked where's the best place to live, and I said I would not recommend places in South America, I made it very clear, but I want to make it clear again. The people in those countries are decent, loving, wonderful human beings. I've been to these countries. The people could not be more kind, but the narco-terrorists are not kind. And who do you think are the people that they rape and steal and murder on a daily basis and an hourly basis throughout South and Central America? It is the narco-terrorists. It is the people who are engaged in moving their drugs or kidnapping young women and then threatening their families. And it's massive. And that's why I don't want anyone put in harm's way by being in a country where the people are great, absolutely. The environment is terrific. But then you never know when one of these gangs are going to try to take a point on you because you're the person that may have money or something that they feel they need. I mentioned the death toll in Mexico as one example. That was 250,000 people. A lot of those were just innocent civilians. A lot of those were members of the gangs. The gangs have increased in power, not decreased. From Colombia, Venezuela, all the way up, The gangs rule. They have enormous power, and their power is gaining. So I'm suggesting places in the world where it is safer. But let us also remember, you have to understand the victims in all these situations. The first victims are always the local people. They don't have the resources to fight back. They don't have the government on their side. They don't have the police on their side. And that's why a lot of them are wanting to come to the United States and bring their children with them. And so we should be empathetic. We should be opening up our hearts, and we should open up places for them to come in, because we're partly responsible for the death squads, for the regime changes, and for all the negative consequences of our diplomatic siding with the oligarchs in their country that caused this gross inequality to begin with. Have a nice day, everyone. I'll see you back tomorrow.